From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Earth to Bush, no Iraq war. That was the message that activists unfurled today over the East River in New York.
Today we'll speak with activists who are on the East River unfurling a banner as President Bush addresses the United Nations calling for war. September 11th, the anniversary of another tragedy, the day the Pinochet regime rose to power in Chile. We'll speak with Joyce Horman. Her husband, Charles Horman, is a U.S. journalist who was killed by Pinochet's men as the coup took over. All that and more coming up. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a day after the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, President Bush will address the United Nations General Assembly. Administration officials say he'll challenge the UN to enforce resolutions requiring Iraq to accept the destruction of its chemical and biological weapons. The U.S. will seek a single, toughly worded Security Council resolution that would authorize military action if Iraq refuses comprehensive inspections. Bush will tell the UN its authority will be wrecked unless it forces Iraq to comply with previous resolutions. This is exactly why people are on the East River across from the United Nations right now. Activists have just hung a gigantic banner. Jason Mark is on the boat. He's with Global Exchange. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks so much, Amy.
Can you tell us what the banner says?
Sure. It said, Earth to Bush, no Iraq war, underscoring the point that the world is essentially unanimous in its opposition to the White House's plans to invade Iraq.
And describe where you are.
We're coming back into port right now. The Secret Service are closing down the East River, and that's why we were out here at dawn today and had our banner up for about an hour.
How did you unfurl the banner?
With four giant helium-filled weather balloons. So we had a mesh banner with the message on it, and then used helium banners off a boat in the river to raise it up and show it to the people of Manhattan and to the folks inside the United Nations.
Jason Mark with Global Exchange, www.earthtobush.com. It's not only protesters who are angry at Bush. The renowned former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, has condemned the United States as, quote, a threat to world peace. In an interview with Newsweek magazine published yesterday, Mandela repeated his call for President Bush not to launch attacks on Iraq and said Bush is trying to please the U.S. arms and oil industries. Mandela also called some of Bush's senior advisors, including Vice President Dick Cheney, dinosaurs. He said the U.S. backing for a coup by the Shah of Iran in 1953 led to Iran's Islamic Revolution. He said U.S. support for Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and its refusal to work with the United Nations after the Soviet withdrawal led to the Taliban taking over. He said, quote, if you look at those matters, you will come to the conclusion that the attitude of the United States of America is a threat to world peace. President Bush also spoke yesterday on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Speaking on Ellis Island, he said, we will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder. Thousands of people packed the area around Ground Zero on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg opened the memorial service just before 8:45 in the morning, the time the first hijacked plane crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center 1 year ago. Former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani then began reading the names of the nearly 3,000 people who were killed in the Twin Towers on that day. Several people participated in the reading, which took around 2 hours. At peace vigils, speakers noted that the names of the undocumented immigrants who died that day were not included in the unofficial reading. Many Muslims stayed at home for fear of hate crimes. F-16 fighters and early warning aircraft patrolled the skies and surface-to-air missiles ringed Washington. Yasser Arafat has suffered what the London Guardian describes as one of the biggest humiliations of his career yesterday when his entire cabinet resigned to avoid a parliamentary vote of no confidence. Two-time nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, Stanley Tookie Williams, could be executed by the state of California as early as next year. On Tuesday, a federal appeals court upheld his death sentence that stems from four murders 23 years ago. At the time, Williams was a member of the Crips, the Los Angeles street gang he helped found. Williams maintains he did not commit the murders. He's become a leading voice condemning gang violence. He's written 9 books, including Tookie Speaks Out Against Gang Violence. He also helped create the Internet Project for Street Peace. A day after the U.S. government awarded the Colombian military $42 million in aid, the nation's president, Álvaro Uribe, took further steps to suspend Colombia's constitution in the name of the war on terror. On Tuesday, the nation's military was granted authority to search private homes and arrest people without a warrant. The army was also given greater power to impose curfews on civilian populations and to restrict travel. And Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader in Leavenworth, is 58 years old today. His mother died on Monday. The federal penitentiary did not grant him permission to attend the funeral. When his father died several years ago, he also could not attend. The prison requires an inmate to pay for the room, the lodging, the salaries, the travel of the guards who accompany a prisoner. The prison said that Leonard Peltier would require 12 guards. The court, though, has agreed to an October 8th hearing that could lead to a reduction of sentence. Leonard Peltier is currently serving 2 consecutive life sentences for the murders of 2 FBI men on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. He continues to maintain his innocence.
I can dream all the greatness and glory the way that it seemed. How God was on our side and God doesn't lie. So why do all these innocent people have to die? Who are they? And why do they hate us? Every color in the cloth has a history to tell. Ships across the ocean and the Liberty Bell. Heroes in the monuments, I know them by name. But now their granite jaws are shattered and their eyes are full of rain. My neighbor, she's a foreigner, I can't pronounce her name. When she talks about her homeland, her face fills with pain. She says she lost her children when the missiles hit. I don't know what to say, so I just change the subject. Who are they? And why do they hate us? I see the TV news and they're burning my flag in some faraway land where it's just another rag. The looks on their faces, they make me freeze. How in the world did we make so many enemies?
You are listening to Democracy Now! Who Are They? By Jim Page. This is Resistance Radio. President Bush is set to address the United Nations General Assembly today. Administration officials say the speech will challenge the UN to enforce resolutions requiring Iraq to accept the destruction of its chemical and biological weapons. The U.S. says it is seeking a single, toughly worded Security Council resolution that would authorize military action if Iraq refuses comprehensive inspections. Bush will tell the U.N. that its authority will be wrecked unless it forces Iraq to comply with previous resolutions. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan will speak before Bush and will argue that the U.S. must not take action without a Security Council mandate. His office took the unusual step of releasing his remarks last night. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced it is preparing to send hundreds of military staff from the U.S. Central Command to Qatar in November. Pentagon officials say the staff will probably form the core battle planning staff for an attack on Iraq. Bush's speech to the United Nations comes on the heels of a speech he gave last night on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks on Ellis Island.
The attack on our nation was also an attack on the ideals that make us a nation. Our deepest national conviction is that every life is precious, because every life is the gift of a creator who intended us to live in liberty and equality. More than anything else, this separates us from the enemy we fight. We value every life. Our enemies value none, not even the innocent, not even their own. And we seek the freedom and opportunity that give meaning and value to life. There is a line in our time, and in every time, between those who believe that all men are created equal and those who believe that some men and women and children are expendable in the pursuit of power. There is a line in our time and in every time between the defenders of human liberty and those who seek to master the minds and souls of others. Our generation has now heard history's call, and we will answer it. America has entered a great struggle that tests our strength and even more our resolve. Our nation is patient and steadfast. We continue to pursue the terrorists in cities and camps and caves across the earth. We are joined by a great coalition of nations to rid the world of terror. And we will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder. Now and in the future, Americans will live as free people, not in fear, and never at the mercy of any foreign plot or power. This nation has defeated tyrants and liberated death camps, raised this lamp of liberty to every captive land. We have no intention of ignoring or appeasing history's latest gang of fanatics trying to murder their way to power. They are discovering, as others before them, the resolve of a great country and a great democracy. In the ruins of two towers, under a flag unfurled at the Pentagon, at the funerals of the lost, we have made a sacred promise to ourselves and to the world. We will not relent until justice is done and our nation is secure. What our enemies have begun, we will finish.
President Bush speaking last night at Ellis Island on the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. We're joined on the telephone right now by Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., a journalist who specializes in the Middle East and the United Nations, and is author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. The banner headlines, Phyllis, today, the New York Times, straight across the top, Bush to warn UN, act on Iraq or U.S. will, he leads nation in mourning at terror sites. Your response to what seems to be exactly what Andrew Card said it would be, the Bush chief of staff, former auto industry lobbyist, when asked why it's now that the president is amping up the PR campaign to bomb Iraq, Andrew Card responded, from a marketing point of view, you don't launch a new product in August. Phyllis Bennis.
I think that we're seeing, on the one hand, an absolute ramping up, as you say, of the propaganda to justify a unilateral war, and in just the last several days, a shift in the tactics of that propaganda campaign to take into account the United Nations, not by consulting and drawing multilateral conclusions and using the UN as a forum for serious debate within the international community, but doing very much what President Bush's father, Bush Sr., did 12 years ago. He went to the United Nations to use it as an instrument of justification of a unilateral war to be justified in the name of a multilateral institution. We're seeing exactly the same thing being played out now. The words of President Bush are thoroughly undermining the role and the centrality of the United Nations in global affairs by saying that we want the UN to endorse what I want it to endorse, not we want the UN to make a decision. We want a UN endorsement of what we have already planned to do. It's very much in keeping, Amy, I think, with the line that has come to characterize Bush's approach to to this entire crisis since 9/11 of last year in saying, you're either with us or with the terrorists. He is now in the process of treating the United Nations as if it, too, were, in his view, representative of terrorism.
And yet he's going to the United Nations.
He is. And that reflects, I think, a recognition in the Bush administration that the international isolation posed simply too overwhelming a problem on the propaganda front if they didn't do something to mitigate it, both at the governmental level, where governments around the world were so far, and I am skeptical how long this would last, but so far are remaining adamant in refusing to jump on board this Bush-led train towards war in Iraq. And similarly, in the United States, the split within elite opinion, the split within the Republican Party, within the Congress, within the administration, even within the military, within the corporate media, the split in all of those arenas has put in place a set of fairly discrete examples of why the Bush position is not acceptable to those elite opponents. And one of the main ones has emerged as there has not been UN approval. Now, I don't think that most of those elite critics in the United States necessarily believe that the United Nations is, in fact, the repository of international legitimacy and, in fact, needs to be the central actor in dealing with international crises, which is, I think, what international law, in fact, requires. But there is a sense that there should be some kind of an imprimatur by the United Nations before the U.S. moves. And many people, I think, believe that the Security Council will not be prepared to actually endorse a military strike on Iraq, a U.S. military strike. I think that the Bush administration jumped on, for example, the words day before yesterday of French President Jacques Chirac, who posed the possibility of a two-part resolution to be passed in the Security Council, the first which would call for the entry of inspectors back into Iraq within 3 weeks, and if there were to be any violation by Iraq, if they refused or if the inspectors were not allowed to complete their work as the UN required, that the council would then meet again to determine the outcome. The Bush administration response to that was to say, well, that's an interesting possibility because then, of course, the outcome would be authorization of a military strike. In fact, I think that the intention of the French president and others who have endorsed, at least tentatively, his proposal is precisely the opposite, that there should be a unified call on Iraq to accept the inspectors, and if there were a future problem, it would come back to the council for more debate, not that it would be an automatic granting of legitimacy to a U.S. or other kind of military strike.
And what do you think of Kofi Annan's role right now in giving this speech, which really, in a way, underscores President Bush's right after?
Well, it's a very interesting question, Amy. I think that Kofi Annan's speech made very clear that this is a moment when the United Nations has to be protected from efforts by the United States to undermine it. The idea that the Secretary General would distribute his speech ahead of time is unprecedented at the UN. It's not the usual practice. And in the speech, he was quite explicit in directing his remarks to the United States, to the Bush administration, who in saying that we in the United Nations understand our role within the Security Council, that that's the only place for legitimacy. In his words, there is no substitute for the unique legitimacy provided by the United Nations. And he spoke about how, in the words of the Charter, he said that any state, if attacked, retains the inherent right of self-defense under Article 51. But beyond that, and he went on to say that the only other way that a state can use force is when it is authorized by the Security Council. I think this was an effort to fairly directly undermine the Bush administration's effort to use Article 51, which is the one place where self-defense is authorized in the UN Charter, as the basis of an attack on Iraq, as they did in Afghanistan. And, of course, the problem with that analysis is that Article 51 is very explicit in saying that self-defense is a right that accrues only if a country has been attacked. It doesn't happen ahead of time. So this notion of preemptive strikes does not fall within the UN Charter. It stands as a violation. Now, traditionally, and Kofi Annan's speech of this morning, which he's about to give in, I think, about 20 minutes, is not an exception to this. The Secretary General does not harshly condemn even the most egregious threats, in this case by the United States, to undermine the United Nations. It's a very moderate and very diplomatic approach. But the words are quite unmistakable, Amy, I think, when in the discussion of multilateralism, it's a very direct rebuke to the clear unilateralism that has come to characterize the Bush administration.
And finally, Nelson Mandela condemning the United States as a threat to world peace, saying, if you look at those matters, you'll come to the conclusion that the attitude of the United States of America is a threat to world peace, saying the U.S. Backing the coup by the Shah of Iran in 53 led to Iran's Islamic Revolution, saying Vice President Dick Cheney and other senior advisors of Bush are dinosaurs, and that U.S. support for Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and its refusal to work with the UN after the Soviet withdrawal led to the Taliban taking power.
Mandela's speech, Amy, was an extraordinary statement. It was a very explicit condemnation of the U.S. for acting, although he didn't use this word, but really what he said was that the U.S. is acting as a rogue state and represents itself a threat to the peace and security of the world as it claims to be acting against those it determines to be a threat to its own version of stability around the globe. And given the extraordinary moral credibility of the South African leader, who has been quite reticent in the years since he turned over the presidency after the election of Thabo Mbeki, Mandela has been quite careful in choosing his forum and choosing the topic for his public presentations. He's been very cautious. So for him to emerge with a very harsh condemnation of these UN threats, of these UN, U.S. efforts to undermine the UN and its threats to the peace and security on a worldwide basis, represented a very serious challenge, I think, that the Bush administration will be very hard-pressed to meet when Bush gives his speech an hour from now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phyllis. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. September 11th marks events in a number of countries. On Wednesday, Chileans mark the 29th anniversary of the bloody coup that was led by Augusto Pinochet. In that coup, following that coup, September 11th, 1973, thousands of Chileans lost their lives. Tomorrow we're going to talk about Another September 11th, September 11th, 1990, the day Guatemalan anthropologist Myrna Mack was murdered by Guatemalan officers backed by the U.S. Three of them are currently on trial in Guatemala City, and we're going to talk with Myrna Mack's sister Helen and her lawyer, whose 16-year-old son was threatened with death yesterday. But today we're going to Spain to speak with Joyce Horman. Joyce Horman was the wife of Charles Horman, an American journalist who was killed by Pinochet's army. And Joyce Horman is currently suing the U.S. government, National Security Advisor and former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, for support of the Pinochet coup and its role in her husband's death. Joyce Horman, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's very good of you to be with us as you take this trip through Spain. In fact, is your trip related to your lawsuit against the U.S. government?
I have to actually correct that. The lawsuit we have open right now is against Pinochet and his military subordinates, especially the ones who were in charge in the National Stadium Detention Center where my husband was killed in Chile. And listed as witnesses are Henry Kissinger and Nathaniel Davis and Fred Purdy, who were American officials at that time, and who, as we see from the declassified documents, not only knew very much about the coup in Chile, but were in support of it and also in support of Pinochet after he took power in support of an operations, a sort of business-as-usual attitude in the face of enormous criminal acts against the victims of the coup by Pinochet forces. We did have a case in the late 70s against Kissinger and other members of the Nixon State Department for information about the death of Charles, also questions of cover-up and collusion and negligence were also charged or brought to the court at that time. But that case came up against documents that were very much obliterated. And so that case, we asked that it be closed with permission to reopen if we could find information. So it was closed in the early 80s, just before the movie came out.
The movie right now, being missing that
the movie being
by Costa Gavras.
Missing. Yes, thank you very much. And so now, even though Pinochet has been excused, our case is still open in Chile, and it's an investigation of what happened in the National Stadium with regard to my husband, and also examining Judge Guzman in Chile is examining the behavior of U.S. officials towards North American citizens. And last May, several North Americans went to Chile to testify about their experience as detainees in the National Stadium and also as their to be a witness as to what happened in the stadium. And Judge Guzman recreated at that time sort of the position of these witnesses and how they were able to hear gunshots and executions and to see people marched in one direction or another.
And does Judge Guzman have anything to do with why you're in Spain now?
Judge Guzman is in Chile, and the reason I'm in Spain right now is I was invited for the remembrances of Chile on September 11th, remembering the coup, but more than that, remembering the heroes of the struggle for human rights and against the crimes that were committed there and elsewhere around the world. And also remembering that the terrorist state of Pinochet was supported by the U.S. government at that time. I say terrorist state because Pinochet forces went across borders. They went to Argentina to kill Carlos Prats and his wife. They went to Italy to attack Leighton and his wife. Who survived, but they went to the state, to the United States, the streets of Washington, to car bomb Orlando Letelier, who was an enormously important worker for human rights at that time, and especially making the world conscious of what was happening in Pinochet's Chile. So it's an important day for remembering all sorts of things, and enormous sadness for what happened a year ago in the United States. But it seems very important, having worked for so many years for human rights in Chile, to also remember the history that surrounds some of these enormous human rights tragedies.
Do you feel with the documents that have been declassified now around, for example, Henry Kissinger, that you would reopen the case and the lawsuit against him?
It's a matter of finding some very specific details. And yes, if those details were to become available to us, we certainly would reopen that case.
And what are the documents that so far have come out? What is most significant about them?
I think what's most significant is that 20 years ago they covered up a paragraph that said the then State Department thought our case should be investigated because there was circumstantial evidence that led them to think that the U.S. intelligence agencies had played an unfortunate role in the death of Charles Horman. Now, this is something that U.S. citizens have to understand and have to know more about. And so for that paragraph, for that opinion to have been covered up for 20 years kept us from understanding that they, too, thought the case should be investigated. It weakened our own case not to know this. So that's the most significant thing for us that has come out. Of course, there has been recently two very significant findings about the Condor operation that crossed borders and took people from one country to another to instances of torture and murder. It's an incredible conspiracy of crimes against humanity that has been uncovered there. And, of course, Henry Kissinger was not only the head of the State Department then, he was the head of the 40 Committee, he was the head of all of the intelligence agencies for the United States. So the buck stops there, and this man really should answer a lot of questions that have been raised because of these declassified documents.
Finally, your connections between the September 11th that we certainly all know and mourn last September 11th, where 3,000 people here in New York alone were incinerated in a moment, and the September 11th that you certainly know well in 1973 in Chile.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear.
Any connections that you draw between the different September 11ths?
I guess what occurs to me is that there were enormous human rights abuses in Chile that were not only overlooked by the U.S. Government at that time, but deliberately obscured. And the Pinochet regime was really a terrorist state. And the U.S. attitude at that time towards this terrorist state was not appropriate. It was supportive. It was not attacking it. It was not trying to find out who was committing the murders and so forth. And the attitude now, extraordinary attitude of going to war and bombing populations, it's very bellicose so many steps are being taken sort of beyond our constitutional laws that are not good for us and not good for the world. This is the difference between the September 11th that I see. It doesn't mean that I'm not enormously sad with other New Yorkers about what happened and the losses that were incurred. They're enormous and terrible. But the attitude of the U.S. government is inappropriate and inexcusably warlike at this point.
Joyce Horman, I want to thank you for being with us. Joyce Horman, widow of Charles Horman, U.S. journalist who was killed in Chile as the Pinochet regime rose to power. Salvador Allende, the democratically elected leader of Chile, died on September 11th as Pinochet's troops took over. You are listening to Democracy Now! At the same time that the protests, that the observances of last September 11th have been taking place around the world, have been a variety of events There were peace rallies being held around the nation. In Los Angeles, relatives of the victims of the September 11th attacks brought a packed Baptist church to its feet, calling for no war on Iraq. In New York and Washington Square Park, thousands gathered on the eve of the anniversary for an overnight peace vigil. Among those who spoke at that event were Manning Marable, professor of African American Studies at Columbia University. This is what he had to say.
It is still morning time here in New York City. No matter how much time passes, the tragedy of the terrorist attack against the World Trade Center towers will remain brutally fresh and terribly vivid for millions of people who live in this city. For those of us who live and work here, for those of us who love this city, our grief is still overwhelming. There can be no justification, there can be no excuse, no rationale for the deliberate use of deadly force and unprovoked violence against any civilian population. But this was not essentially an act of war, but it was a criminal act, a crime against not just the American people, but all of humanity. One fairly standard definition of terrorism is the use of extra-legal extremist violence and coercion against a civilian or non-combatant population. Terrorist acts may be employed to instill fear and mass intimidation to achieve a political objective. By any criteria, Al-Qaeda is a terrorist organization. That is true. Most Americans have never experienced terrorism, but we Americans have unleashed terrorism against others, millions throughout the world. The mass lynchings, the public executions, the burnings at the stake of thousands of African Americans in the early 20th century were homegrown domestic acts of terrorism. The genocide of millions of American Indians was objectively a calculated plan for mass terrorism. The dropping of the atomic bomb on Japanese cities in World War II, resulting in the fiery incineration of hundreds of thousands of people, was a crime against humanity. The U.S.-sponsored coup against the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile on 9/11/1973, culminated in the mass torture, the rapes, the executions of thousands of people. That was nothing less than state-financed terrorism. And so there is a common political immorality that links the terrorists of 9/11, the terrorists Osama bin Laden, Augusto Pinochet, and Henry Kissinger, they all traffic in terrorism. We are now witnessing dissident profiling in this country, the proliferation of electronic surveillance, roving wiretapping, harassment at the workplace, the infiltration and disruption of anti-war groups, the stigmatization of any critics of U.S. militarism are viewed as disloyal and disruptive. But I believe that one cannot preserve democracy by destroying the democratic rights of any individual or group in this country. I believe that to publicly oppose a government's policies that one believes to be morally and politically wrong, as Dr. King asserted, is to express the strongest belief in the principles of democracy. For those of us who oppose our government's course of action must clearly explain to the American people that the missile strikes and indiscriminate carpet bombings that we have unleashed against the people of the world of Afghanistan and other parts of the world will not make us safer. The policies of the Bush administration actually put our lives in greater danger. Because the use of government-sponsored terror will not halt brutal retaliations by those who carry out terror. The national security state apparatus we are constructing in this country is being designed primarily to suppress domestic dissent and not to halt terrorists from coming in the country. The war against terrorism, the so-called war, is used as an excuse to eliminate civil liberties and democratic rights for the American people themselves. This war against at home has a profoundly racial dimension. Because the U.S. democracy was constructed on a racial foundation, the government always has found it difficult to present a clear democratic argument to advance the interest in the pursuit of warfare. Instead, it relies on and manipulates the latent racism and the xenophobia at all levels of our society. Usually, that racism is used to target external enemies, such as the Japanese during World War II. But in general, wherever the United States mobilizes militarily, whenever the United States goes to war, white racism goes with it hand in hand. There is a clear link between 9/11 and the shameful political maneuvering committed by the United States at the World Conference Against Racism last year in Durban, only days before the attacks. There, the U.S. government opposed the definition of slavery as a crime against humanity. It opposed and refused to acknowledge the historical and contemporary effects of colonialism and segregation on the underdeveloped and oppression of non-European people. The dark, the vast majority of humankind, dark humanity is saying to the United States that racism, that militarism, are not the solutions to the world's major problems. According to the United Nations, the world's 225 wealthiest individuals have a combined net wealth of $1 trillion, which was equal to the combined income of the planet's most impoverished 2.5 billion people. One half of the people currently living on this planet, slightly more than 3 million people, exist on the equivalent of $2 or less a day. For them, globalization is nothing less than a new phase of racialization on a global scale. To stop, so let me conclude, 2 points. To stop the extraordinary violence of terrorism, we must stop the daily violence of class inequality, of globalization, and of poverty. To engage in the struggle for justice, to find new paths toward reconciliation across the boundaries of religion, culture, and color is the only way to protect our cities. It is the only way to protect our country and ourselves from the terrible violence of terrorism. Because without justice, there can be no peace. Martin Luther King, let me close with this. Martin Luther King said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice." We must make it bend toward justice this evening by saying no to racism. No to racial profiling. We say no to the war that is going to be launched against Iraq. We say no, and we say yes to peace. We say yes to humanity. We say yes, and the struggle continues until the peace, till justice is won. Thank you.
Professor Manning Marable of Columbia University, radical historian. This is Democracy Now! He was speaking at a peace vigil on the eve of September 11th. If you'd like to get a video or audio or CD cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. When we come back, Kathy Kelly and Julia Butterfly. Stay with us.
Luma ke watch lunu li don fula sulle wa fe tu kale luma ta go wa fe tu kale wa fe tu kale luma ta go wa fe tu kale.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Aurelia here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to the Washington Square Park rally with Kathy Kelly, who's co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, established in 1996 to seek an end to UN sanctions against Iraq. Voices has brought Americans into Iraq to witness the effects of sanctions, to deliver food and medicine, and to educate the U.S. public. Kathy Kelly has twice been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Thank you, all of you, for being voices for peace amidst cries for war. Maybe one of the things that took some real courage on my part, once in 1991, before going over to Iraq during the Gulf War, was to go home to my mother's house to tell her what I was about to do. And as I left, having not been able to sell this idea at all, she shouted out to me in her thick Irish brogue, "Kathy, what about the incubators? What about the incubators?" And my mother was remembering a young Kuwaiti woman's compelling story that had been testimony before the U.S. Congress, that she had seen Iraqi soldiers dump Kuwaiti babies out of incubators and then run away and steal the incubators. And my mother said, "They've got to be stopped. You can't allow people like that to continue." But 6 months after the war ended, the Gulf War in 1991, enterprising journalists went to Kuwait and they discovered that the story was a hoax. Young Nayera had never left the United States. She, the daughter of a Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States and a very prestigious public relations firm, had trained people to market that war. This past weekend, Mr. Andrew Card, now hired to market the new war, although in many ways the war has never ended against Iraq, Mr. Andrew Card tried to reassure people. He said, "Everybody knows. You never bring out a new product in August. And so they'll try to roll out the new war in September." But we know that Hiroshima and Nagasaki happened in August. The guns of war in World War I happened in August. The economic sanctions were imposed on Iraq on August 2nd, 1990. And now, 12 years after the most devastating state of siege ever imposed in modern history, I can't come to you and tell you why do they hate us so much. I come back bewildered, asking, why do they love us so much? From Iraq, the letters came immediately after September 11th. They were handwritten, many of them in pencil, asking, please, tell your people how sorry we are. They echoed what mothers said at their children's bedside as they would tell us, "Believe us, we pray this will never happen to a mother in your country," minutes before a child died. They echoed the sentiments of people who said, We know that you are not your government, that your people would never do this to us. And in a way, they echo what Mr. Colin Powell said on September 11th. The people who perpetrated that barbarous act thought that by killing people and destroying buildings, you could achieve a political goal. And then Colin Powell said, they are always wrong. And so we have the mirror into which we must look to gain political maturity. We're a young country. We must look into the mirror of truth and see that at times we've not been able to hear the cries of grief of others and to welcome and reverence those who taught us so well this year that our grief is not a cry for war.
Kathy Kelly, speaking at a peace vigil on the eve of the September 11th observance yesterday. Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness just concluded a 40-day fast in front of the United Nations protesting U.S. sanctions against Iraq and the continued bombing of the country. You are listening to Democracy Now! Among the other people who were at the protest was Julia Butterfly Hill. On December 18, 1999, Julia inspired millions when she triumphantly descended from the giant redwood tree that she called Luna, concluding a two-year tree sit, which resulted in the protection of a group of redwood trees in Humboldt County, California. More recently, Julia Butterfly was deported from Ecuador in July after being detained along with seven Ecuadorians for a peaceful protest against the construction of an oil pipeline through Ecuador's Amazon region. The oil pipeline targeted by the environmentalists is over 500 kilometers long and is to transport petroleum from the Ecuadorian Amazon across the Andes to the Pacific coast for refining and export. Julia Butterfly, you've been traveling the globe recently. What brought you to Washington Square?
Well, I came because I have been working actually with a group of visionary business leaders who believe that as business leaders, as people, they have a consciousness of peace. And as business leaders, they're mandated to kind of step out as business leaders for peace. And they were supporting some of the Peaceful Tomorrow's vigil that was held. So I came to be there and be in witness that there are many people that believe there's another solution to violence besides using more violence, that's never going to bring about the lasting peace our world needs. And to carry that message and to be an individual person in a message for peace in this time that people's fears and people's sadnesses are being used as a screen and as a button to push to justify the Bush administration's hunger for war.
Can you talk about your trip to Ecuador and what happened, what landed you in an Ecuadorian prison?
Sure, and it really ties right in with what's going on because what happened on September 11th and our response as a and the administration's response to it is really about the war over resources. And a lot of power comes from who controls the resources, and unfortunately, we're seeing that because America is addicted to resources and disposability and all the resources we throw away on a daily basis, it creates a pressure around the world. And we have this equation in our mind that says freedom equals our right to do whatever we want, and which translates into buy whatever we want and then throw it away. And what's happening, this translates into what's happening in Ecuador because of our addiction to oil. What's really interesting is that I went there to stand in solidarity with the people of Ecuador to stand up against the oil pipeline. And what we came in contact with time and time again was military police. And what I found out while I was there is that most of that military police in Ecuador is funded by the U.S. war on drugs. And I thought it was interesting because I think our largest addiction in this country is the drug of oil. And so this pipeline is being protected by these military police who have no qualms about doing anything to anyone. I ended up going to Ecuador because I had heard about tree sitters in the Mindo region in a cloud rainforest that's just spectacular. Literally hundreds of species that exist nowhere else in the world. It seemed that life was growing on top of life, and where that life was growing, there was something crawling on top of that. It was just this incredible, every inch was teeming with diversity. And they're putting this pipeline through in this Mindo region. The indigenous people said, we don't want it here. And they tried everything they could. And then they heard about the tree sits that happened in California, including the Luna tree sit that I was a part of, and said, that's what we're going to do. And so they took to the trees. And it was when I heard about that that I made a commitment to go. And that's what brought me there.
Explain what you mean by tree sit for those who aren't familiar with what you did and what many others are doing.
Tree sitting is a form of protest where people actually climb into the trees and live to try and halt devastation of an ecosystem and peoples who live there, to try and call attention. That's one of the largest reasons for tree sits, is to try and bring a spotlight to the point where a place is becoming a product and show people what happens to the place and the people and the animals who live there when we consume as we do. So tree sitting actually came to the United States over 15 years ago from England as a form of protest. So I was not the first tree sitter, nor am I the last. People are still in the trees as we speak. In Ecuador, the tree sitters came down and were able to purchase the land, and now they're trying to come from that angle. It's very difficult for them to do things like tree sits there because every member of the family is needed in the survival of the family. So it's very, very hard for people in those regions to go miles away from their community and take their support of that community up into the woods. So they've been trying everything they could, and that's why I decided I had to go. What I went through in Ecuador pales in comparison to what these people have been going through for over 20 years.
So you were ultimately deported?
That's right. It was very interesting. The whole thing ended up happening on the last day. I thought, wow, okay, nothing's going to happen. I've been here I was there for about 12 or 13 days. And I was expecting, it was the last day, I thought, well, we've made it through. We had a couple of points of confrontation where I thought, this might be a point where I'm about to be arrested. And every time, the incredible Ecuadorians that I was with did such a wonderful job of holding a line of peace very strongly in the midst of some intense situations. I toured the pipeline. I saw devastation. I passed 3 oil spills in one day.
And the pipeline has been constructed by which company?
It's a consortium called the OCP Consortium, and it's made up of Occidental Oil, which is, you know, that's one of those companies that every time you hear about a problem surrounding oil, their name's right there, with support from Alberta Energy in Canada, Care McGee, the bank financing the pipeline is from Germany. There's an Italian company, so it's a consortium of different ones. And then,
is the World Bank involved?
Oh, yes. The World Bank is involved in that they helped fund the pipeline. And most of the money from the pipeline is not even going to the Ecuadorian government and people. What little of it is going to the Ecuadorian government and people, 80% of it is mandated by the World Bank to go back to pay back the loan.
Are you going to be at the World Bank protests and in Washington at the end of September?
I am not going to be able to be there, although I'm doing my best to mobilize people to be there. I was there in the last round, and it was very interesting because I was almost arrested on the streets, and then a few months later ended up being in a meeting in the building where they had me come in. And I started laughing in the beginning of the meeting, and I said, you do understand, a couple of months ago you tried to have me arrested, right? And they said, yes. And so that was an interesting dialogue. But in Ecuador, I was eventually arrested and deported. We're still trying to figure out what the charges were. There were 2 letters asking for my deportation, and they were both from the oil companies.
Well, Julia Butterfly, I want to thank you for being with us. Julia Butterfly Hill wrote a book about the tree and the struggle to save the redwoods called The Legacy of Luna. You are listening to Democracy Now! That ends the program. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, sitting in for Anthony Sloan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.